Chapter 13. I flew back to London a couple of days later and handed in to David Frost the first draft of The Rise and Rise of Michael Remmer. At that moment, however, he had much bigger fish to fry. His new three-times-a-week show, The Frost Programme, which was due to start in less than a month. It was an attempt to create a new format with a much wider mix of ingredients than had ever been tried on British television before. Serious political interviews, mixed in with entertainment items, occasional sketches, light-hearted pieces which sometimes involved the guests. I remember ringing handbells with Jeremy Thorpe, the leader of the Liberal Party at that time, the odd singer, stunts. I once tried to see how much Mandarin Chinese I could learn in a week. Answer? Not a lot. Very occasional film items, no show business chit-chat that I can remember, but otherwise only the kitchen sink was omitted. Once, when the singer Shirley Bassey was a guest, Terry Gilliam was invited to the studio to sketch her. David then panicked, racing into the wings during a commercial break to make sure Terry's portrait was not unflattering. Fortunately, it wasn't. Terry must have needed the work. Once the Frost programme had bedded down a bit, it evolved into a very interesting hybrid and became the talk of London town. It did not, however, become the talk of the country because it was only shown in certain regions. Its absence from television screens in Weston-super-Mare alarmed my parents, even though they could still hear me every week on I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. Dad therefore wrote me a letter asking me if I had ever considered applying for a job in the personnel department of Marks and Spencer's. I was able to reassure him that I was not destitute, but I still treasure the moment when, after telling this story on a radio several years later, I opened a letter with Marks and Spencer on it and found that someone had sent me an application form. I took on small roles in the programme. Occasionally I would write a short, generally slightly satirical duologue, which I would perform with David at the start of the show. From time to time, I'd perform a short monologue. I might also join in a light-hearted group item with guests. If required, I came up with something a bit more bizarre, like getting everyone to sing the Clifton College school song. For working days or holidays, and glad or melancholy days, they were great days and jolly days at the best school of all. My other function was to act as a minder for one of that evening's guests, making sure they were happy and were given a drink, just one, before a floor manager came to take them on set for their appearance. And it was while performing this rather easy job that I made my one big slip-up of that autumn. It was a particularly unfortunate cock-up because it came on the back of something of a breakthrough for the show. When the Frost programme started, the one problem that we had was that David found it impossible to secure serious guests. Because he had presented the cutting-edge satirical shows, That Was the Week That Was, and Not So Much a Programme or a Way of Life, which had achieved a pinnacle of irreverence never before reached by British entertainers, and followed that by his Frost Report series that was at least a bit cheeky now and again. All the bigwigs, politicians, generals, ambassadors, top civil servants, professors, bishops, tycoons and such like, wouldn't touch David with three barge poles fastened together with something a lot stronger than sellotape. So, for the first few programmes, David was unable to do any serious interviews at all. And because he couldn't do them, he had no way to prove to VIPs that he was intending to do proper duologues with them and not sit them on whoopee cushions or send them up rotten. And then we hooked one. Not a big fish, but at least a hake. A former cabinet minister in the Macmillan government called Ernest Marples, who had been Minister of Transport. There was great excitement. Careful preparations were made. We went out of our way to ensure that when Mr. Marples arrived at the studio to talk to David about Japanese business methods, which he'd been studying in Tokyo for a couple of months, he would be greeted in a suitably sober and respectful way by lots of 50 and over men in dark suits, nearly fawning on him. When he entered the green room, where I was sitting on the sofa guarding the guests that I'd been allocated, everyone jumped to their feet and half-bowed and stood respectfully for a bit, and then, not wanting to bother the ex-minister, sat down and made sure that they didn't stare at him. And it was at that moment I realized that my guest had disappeared. He had blindsided me, and now there he was, bearing down on Mr. Ernest Marples, the ex-cabinet minister, with his hand outstretched and beaming. "Good evening, Mr. Marples." "Good evening." I was paralysed. I could see what was coming. "My name is Martin Braithwood. I'm on the show with you." "Oh, really? What are you doing, Martin?" "I'm playing the spoons." I wish I had a sculpture of Marples' expression. I would contemplate it whenever I felt melancholy. It was the look of a man who had prepared himself for the worst and had badly underestimated. He, an ex-cabinet minister, was about to appear on national television with a spoon player. So much for his chances as the next Chancellor of the Exchequer. Fortunately, he went on anyway. The interview turned out well. Word went round, and within a couple of weeks, the pillars of society were queuing up to talk to David Frost. And what a remarkably fine interviewer he was. Sharp, agile, and yet empathetic, he could get people to say more than they'd planned, which paradoxically often redounded to their credit. And he would also forensically take apart a weak case. His spontaneity proved far more effective with audiences than the usual cliched current affairs minuets. And some of his now largely forgotten interviews, for example with Major Mike Hoare, the Congo mercenary, and Emil Savundra, the con man, were, along with Melvyn Bragg's wonderful conversation with the dying playwright Dennis Potter, among the very best I've ever seen. As for me, although my contribution to the show was small and sometimes absolutely minute, being involved in it proved an extraordinarily valuable experience. The 3 times a week live performing of material, sometimes written only 6 hours before, forced upon me a different mindset from the one I'd had in the Frost Report. There, I could aim to give perfect performances, and the knowledge of this put extra pressure on me. Now, I had to accept that everything I did was going to be a bit under-rehearsed, that perfection was way out of my reach, and that I should just go with the flow and not get uptight about the boo-boos. And I learned that when you stop concentrating on avoiding mistakes, you relax a bit, and consequently, you actually make fewer. Meanwhile, David had informed me at the end of the summer that he wanted to give me a show of my own. I was both flattered and very scared, but came to the conclusion that since I could surround myself with a team of hand-picked people, I wouldn't have to carry too much responsibility myself and would therefore be able to cope. I always strongly believed in safety in numbers. So it turned out, did Tim Brooke Taylor. When David had earlier asked him to do a series, he too had said that he wanted to work with others, and he'd proposed that he and I team up. But unfortunately, I was too busy at that time on other projects. Now the two of us bowed to the obvious and proposed to David that we should work together. David sensed that even as a duo, we were a little apprehensive about the new venture, but he comforted his two scaredy cats by explaining that we wouldn't have to worry about a large TV audience because the show would go out late at night and that, in any case, expectations were non-existent. Then he dangled what, for me, was the perfect carrot. He encouraged us to do the zanier, wilder, off-the-ball, madcap, out-of-left-field, oddball and wackier material that Gray and I used to suggest in the Frost Report script meetings, the material that had always met with the response, "Very funny, boys, but they won't get it in Bradford." So now, Tim and I said, "Yes, please." Involving Graham in the new venture was a no-brainer, but our other suggestion was, on the surface at least, rather bizarre. "David, you'll be a bit surprised at this. Go on." "Marty Feldman." "Marty But Marty's not a performer. And David was correct. Marty hadn't performed since his arrow-firing days on Margate Pier. He was, first and foremost, a writer. But we wheedled away, telling David, who knew what fine scripts Marty would provide for us, that Marty was extraordinarily funny, not just when he was fooling around, but when he spontaneously went into characters as a Cockney barrow boy or a Hollywood film producer or an oleaginous men's outfitter or a wily gypsy fortune teller, until David, almost convinced, finally raised his real objection. But what about the way he looks? Having had his say, David, let us get on with it. So Tim, Marty, Graham and I sat down to put together a pilot to convince a TV executive we all liked and trusted, Cyril Bennett of Rediffusion, to commission a short series to be called At Last the 1948 Show. The four of us worked harmoniously. Gray and I still wrote mainly together. Tim therefore joined Marty, but the two writing teams spent a lot of time in the same room. We knew, of course, that we were going to do a show with zany sketches. The question that remained, though, was how were we going to link the sketches? We were all tired of the musical numbers that punctuated That Was the Week That Was, and of the traditional link man a la Frost programmes, and, of course, the Monty Python approach lay a little way in the future. What were we to do? Was there another method? And then we had a breakthrough. What about a link girl? What sort of a girl? Funny, dappy, pretty, bubbly, adorable, but who? You have to understand that throughout my first few years in British television, there was a constant search among male comedians, who are in the vast majority, for girls who were funny and, if possible, pretty too. Our perception was that there weren't many very funny women around, that somehow even talented comedians didn't ultimately want to make fools of themselves. They always seemed to be holding something back. It wasn't until Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders came along in the 1980s that I saw female comedians on television who wholeheartedly went for it. And it was wonderful that for the first time the best women were funnier than the best men. I was genuinely thrilled. As we planned our show, therefore, few, if any, names came immediately to mind. And then, out of the blue, someone said, oh, you should take a look at Amy MacDonald. She had apparently done some very good stage work and was currently appearing in a nightclub in Mayfair. Tim and I, therefore, secured the necessary funds from the Frost organisation to go along to watch her in action. We took our seats, the show started, a chorus line capered out onto the stage, and right there, on the end of the line was someone whom we immediately decided would be perfect for the role that we had in mind, and we just prayed that she would turn out to be Amy. And once the floor show had come to an end and the owner of the club, David Kaye, had done a really hilarious and very rude half-hour routine, he joined us at our table, bringing with him our pick from the end of the line, the lovely Amy MacDonald, as she was always henceforth known. We soon decided we shouldn't get Amy to link the sketches. We would instead write her silly little quickies, at the end of which she would say, and now? I suppose we were trying to send up the whole idea of links, and her delivery was perfect. A little high-pitched and pedantic, Pythonesque shades of Anne Elk, but wonderfully cute and happy with it. One of my favourite Amy interludes started with her holding a newspaper. Hello, I'm the lovely Amy MacDonald. Do you read your horoscope every day? I do. I'm Scorpio. That's the same as Burt Lancaster. Ooh, I wonder what it says today. She consults the paper and reads carefully. Scorpio, your name is Amy MacDonald, and you are reading your horoscope out on television. Ooh, that's really good, isn't it? Not so good for Burt Lancaster, though. And now, with Amy in place, we wrote the pilot script and started rehearsals in early December. They were particularly enjoyable because Tim Gray and I had performed together so often that we immediately fell into a shared style and working method. I'd always thought that Gray was a fine performer, but even so, when the two of us performed together, I never felt quite the connection with him that I had with Tim. We two watched and listened to each other like hawks, which sometimes led to felicities of timing that wouldn't have happened with Grey and me. I suppose I always felt that Grey was ever so slightly away on his own. But then, that was Grey. Marty was the unpredictable quantity. We all knew that he had the potential to be hilarious, but because he hadn't had the chance to pick up much in the way of acting technique, he was erratic. In the early rehearsals, he might do some lines or visual business wonderfully well, and then get it all wrong the next five times, or suddenly manage to perform brilliantly a part of the sketch he'd always flubbed before. He needed an immense amount of rehearsal, and this we were happy to give him, until his performances were so grooved that he could reproduce them reliably. I never forget that the French word for rehearsal is répétition. And Marty was up for it. He was excited that he was at last going to be in front of the camera, and he worked away tirelessly as we made him run some sequences seven or eight times in a row. Nevertheless, to be on the safe side, we kept his roles fairly small in the pilot episode. The net result was that when the day for the recording came and we were placed in front of a studio audience for the first time, we all produced quite polished turns and earned a decent amount of laughter. Given that the material was a bit, or a lot, wackier than most people were used to seeing on television, we were more than satisfied with the reaction we received. A few days later, we sat in a darkened room in the Rediffusion building on Kingsway and watched the tape of the show. 10 seconds after it finished, the door opened and Cyril Bennett looked in. "Pure gold," he said. "Series of six, please." Oh, we were both elated and excited. We instinctively knew we were going to be producing something slightly different. So we started beavering away at the scripts that we would start recording in February because the Christmas break was almost upon us. I'd suggested to Connie that we could see each other over the holidays, so we met in Barbados and stayed in the Blue Water Beach Hotel just outside Bridgetown. We hadn't spent any time together for about 6 months, and because in those days international phone calls seemed very expensive and oddly daunting, we had stayed in contact mainly by airmail letters printed on amazingly light paper so that they would not tax the plane's engines too greatly. There was no question that we loved each other, but I think we both felt a little tentative about where the relationship was going. Being 3,000 miles apart with our careers rooted in different countries made the future feel very uncertain. But we enjoyed our beach holiday. I managed to avoid water skiing. And we were both stunned by seeing Dr. Zhivago one evening. Watching Geraldine Chaplin and Julie Christie, I seemed to receive some intuition of the deep importance of my relationship with Connie. I'd never before taken a message like that away from a cinema. And on our last evening, God gave us a present. We were sitting under the stars when Harry Secombe sat down next to me. I'd never met Harry before, but I'd adored him in the Goon Show and always sensed that he was, as we say in show business, wonderful. In the flesh, however, he scored comfortably higher in wonderfulness than I'd ever expected. I think warm is the best, if inadequate, word for the man. Connie and I sat chatting to Harry and his wife, and we laughed and laughed. And then I found myself in deep conversation with a man best known for blowing raspberries and singing loudly about theories of time, about which he knew an alarming amount. I came to the conclusion that although he was bonhomie personified, he had a very astute mind. He once told me that at the Palladium he used to get a great reception with all the funny material, but when he sang a bit of opera at the end of the show, he could sense they were fidgeting. Yet, at the end of the aria, they went wild and clapped frantically. And then, one day, he realized they were applauding themselves. Finally, Connie and I went back to our hotel, both thinking that the world seemed a much better place than it had a few hours before. What a man. The next day I flew back to London, thinking how difficult it seemed to foretell the future. I was still naive enough to think it was possible. But, of course, the moment I arrived in London, such speculations were swept aside by the urgent writing requirements of the 1948 show. We had 5 weeks to write 5 episodes and to rewrite the pilot, making 6 altogether. Just the 4 of us, with some help from 3 of the Frost Report team, Dick Vosborough, Eric Idle, and Barry Cryer, all of whom also appeared regularly in both series. But there's a problem trying to chronicle them. The Frost organization wiped all 13 tapes. Really, they no longer exist. You see, back in those Paleozoic times, TV shows were recorded on enormous reels of videotape, which were expensive and also took up a lot of storage space. So, unless a repeat was on the cards, TV companies liked to reuse the tape. A byproduct of this was that they didn't like you to edit the program you'd made, because to do that, you had to cut the tape with a razor blade, and that rendered the tape unfit for future reuse. And for some reason, the companies didn't want the public to know that shows were edited. Don't ask me why. So tape editors were never allowed a credit. But on the 1948 show, we had a great editor called Johnny Fielding, who'd once worked on The Goon Show. And when the powers that be persisted in refusing to roll his name at the end of the 1948 show, we gave him a credit nevertheless. But a credit for choreographing the underwater chariot race. This went through unchallenged. David Frost's hatchet man and Mr. George Brightwell, not wanting to be thought a laggard in this artistic carnage, ordered the wiping of 13 episodes of at last the 1948 show, starring Marty Feldman, Graham Chapman, Tim Brooke Taylor and John Cleese, so that he could free up 4.5 cubic feet of shelf space. George had a reputation as a hard businessman, very hard, the Vinnie Jones of British television executives, except that his suit fitted him better. So hard, in fact, that an immensely well-liked agent called Sonny Zal, at the end of a meeting with George, actually jumped out of George's office window and dropped several floors to his death. There were rumours that George used to leave it open for this express purpose. So, suddenly, there were no tapes for the 1948 show. It was no more. It was an X series. And then, a Swede found 5 reels in the vaults of a Stockholm TV station. Much rejoicing followed, slightly dampened by the discovery that there were not 5 episodes, but 5 half-hour compilations of 1948 show sketches chosen with an eye to Swedish comedy sensibilities. Then, in 2010, when Marty Feldman's widow, Loretta, died, 2 more shows were found in her attic. And at the time of the Python 02 shows, Wilfred Frost, that's David Frost's son and my godson, happened upon another pair somewhere in the Frost archives. In addition, my old PA Howard Johnson combed the internet and found shards of the show out there, 30 seconds of this, a minute of that. So, with the help of the splendid Dick Fiddy, a consultant for the British Film Institute, we are beginning to put them back together again. And recently I've been able to view about 8.5 1948 shows. And because I really liked what I saw when I watched the series, and because it's generally regarded as half a step in the direction of Monty Python, I propose to demonstrate the sort of comedy we were doing by presenting you with extracts from the better sketches. Lazy bastard, I hear you cry, but I believe I can justify my behaviour for several reasons. 1, the sketches are really funny, in my opinion, and it's my fucking book. 2, the 2 series were transmitted just once, decades ago, and even then, not in large areas of the UK, so it's unlikely that you will start thinking, oh, God, not this again. That's why some of the extracts are longer than usual. 3, I know this book is supposed to be an autobiography, but the fact is that most of you don't give a tinker's cuss for me as a human being or feel for the many different forms of suffering that makes me so special. No, you're just flipping through my heart-rending life story in the hope of getting a couple of good laughs, aren't you? So, I'll start with some sketches where I am an authority figure. Ian, the first, I'm a psychiatrist, and Tim, a first-time patient. is having trouble confiding his problem. Tim, well, when I was saying I've started to meet girls in the course of our business and at parties and socially, and well, I don't like to tell them about, well, it's not a thing you can tell people about. Oh, come on, spit it out. Well, sometimes I really... What, you come in here? You won't say what's up. It's all bloody mumbling. I can't hear a word. You're all tensed up like all the other nuts that come in here. You know how much fun this is? Listening to loonies 8 hours a day is so boring. So will you please tell me, in God's name, what the fuck is the matter with you?
I think I'm a rabbit.
You stupid loony! Of course you're not a rabbit. Pull yourselves together. I am a rabbit. Look, if you were a rabbit, you'd have big long ears, wouldn't you? They dropped off when I came in. Look, if you say you're a rabbit once more, I'll smash your face in. Now, what are you?
I'm a dog.
Right, that's better. Here's a bone. You'll take it from there next week. Standard Cleese bullying, but Tim was wonderfully good at being frightened. The terror that he sums up before he blurts out, I think I'm a rabbit, has to be seen to be believed. And it can be. It's on the DVD of salvage footage. Here's another version of me as an authority figure, this time at a zoo, where again I discipline Tim. Me, on phone. I'm seeing the governors for lunch to discuss buying a new tiger, and I'm seeing the giraffe keeper at 3, so I'll see you at 5:30. Voice on phone. Oh, and so are the reptile keepers outside to see you? Bring him in. He hangs up. Several keepers bring in a large snake with a keeper-sized bulge in the middle of it. Lay it down there. They put it on a table and leave. Morning, Lottaby.
Morning, sir. Sorry, sir.
Fourth time he's swallowed you this week, Lottaby. I think he's acquiring a taste for me, sir. I'm getting fed up with this, Lottaby. I don't do it deliberately, sir. I know you. You like loafing around in there. Oh, no, sir. I don't. Any time you feel like taking an afternoon off, you just pop along to the boa constrictor and climb inside. No, sir, swallowing me, I think it's a sign of affection, sir. I'm not having the boa constrictor treated as a restaurant. I'm sorry, sir. Sorry is not enough. It's an expensive business. It costs us £50 every time we operate to get you out. Couldn't you put a zip on it, sir? No, I'm going to teach you a lesson. We're not going to operate this time. We're just going to let nature take its course. Oh, that'll take years, sir. Well, what shall I eat? Second-hand mice. Now that there was no one to warn us that our stuff might not be fully appreciated in Bradford, we were able to push the envelope a little further, but we liked always to set the extra silliness in a familiar context, even a rather bland and reassuringly normal one. It seemed to enhance the lunacy by making it stand out in contrast. Parodies often provided that familiar framework. As Gray and I always love writing sketches where some flawed logic prevailed, which someone was trying urgently to figure out, we hit upon a parody of a popular BBC radio show where schools competed against each other in general knowledge. Good evening and welcome to another edition of Top of the Form. And this evening we're at the semi-final stage, and tonight's contest is between the boys of the King Arthur's Grammar School, Podbury, and the girls of the St. Maria Kangaroo Boot II County High School, and a half. And so, without further ado, let's go straight on to round two. David, what is the name we give to the meat we get from pigs?
Marty Feldman.
Pork. Good. That's 2 marks to you. Marcia, what is the name of the metal alloy that we get from zinc and copper?
Graham Chapman.
Brass?
No, I'm afraid not. The answer is pork. Malcolm, what is the capital of Australia?
Timbrook Taylor.
Sydney?
No, I can see you're not going to get this one. The capital of Australia is pork. Arthur, who wrote A Tale of Two Cities? Pork? Good, that's 2 marks to you. And so on to Stig's question. Stig, what was the date of Captain Cook's discovery of Australia? Pork? Good. 2 marks. And the last question of this round to you, Lust. Can you quote the first 2 lines of Thomas Gray's elegy written in a country book. Good. And the score at the end of round two, please, Joan Sharp.
Well, the score at the end of round two is the boys of King Arthur's Grammar School, Podbury 3, and the girls of Middleton Hall Grain Boiling Institute, Salmon Tooth 4.
A TV caption shows the score tied at 4 each. Thank you, Joan. And so on to round one. Tell the difference. David, what is the difference between a monsoon and a mongoose?
Marty Feldman.
A monsoon is a long plastic pole you hang out of windows at an angle to keep the birds away, and a mongoose is a box you lock books up in for Easter.
No, I can only give you a half for that, but I can offer it to you, Marcia.
Timbrook Taylor.
Pork? No, you're guessing, aren't you? Well, a monsoon is a wind, and a mongoose isn't.
In the context of the familiarity of the TV interview format, we also wrote a two-hander where the interviewer has an odd reaction to certain words.
Good evening. Tonight we're taking a look at beekeeping, and here to tell us all about it, we have in the studio a man who's been keeping bees for over 40 years, Mr. Reginald Prawnbaum. Good evening, Mr. Prawnbaum.
Good evening.
Tell me, what first interested you in the bee world, Mr. Prawnbaum?
Well, even as a child, I used to...
I'm sorry, shouldn't I have said that?
No, of course you should. Pay no attention.
When I say, shh, it's just a nervous mannerism I picked up. If I want you to keep quiet, I will say, shush.
You were saying? Oh, I see. Well, even as a child, I used to wander around, in the fields near my house, watching bees fly from flower to flower, and taking note of the flowers they visited, shush.
Oh, was that wrong? I'm so sorry.
Did I say shush? I meant shh. Do go on. It's most interesting. And so I have grown to love the little shush creatures. You know, nature really has produced a little masterpiece in the life of the bee. Sorry. I'm afraid that's a reflex action too. I squawk when anyone ever mentions the word life. See, when I mentioned it myself, I should have told you. Please, go on.
Oh, very well. Well, our bees, as you know, are divided into different categories. The queen bee and the worker bee, whose lifespan, whose living expectancy is only 1 year. The worker bees, on the other hand, have a much longer...
Shush.
You want me to stop?
Yes, you were about to say life.
And so on. I rate this as one of the best 10 sketches I've written in my entire life. And if you don't agree, there's a great performance of this on iTunes, where the wonderful Rowan Atkinson is playing the part of the interviewer. So you see what I mean about the logic. Here's one more, where Marty slowly drives me mad when he enters an old-fashioned train compartment where I am sitting alone. Marty, excuse me, is this seat occupied? He points to the seat next to JC in the otherwise empty, spacious carriage.
JC,
no.
Marty Feldman puts the case overhead and sits down as close as possible to JC and fidgets. Pause.
Excuse me, would you mind if I change places with you?
What?
Could I sit there?
Yes, I suppose so. JC stands and moves to the opposite seat. Marty Feldman moves his overhead case and then sits across from JC.
Do you mind if I smoke?
No, not at all.
I wish I had a cigarette.
What?
I wish I had a cigarette.
Do you want a cigarette? JC holds out a cigarette for him.
No, I don't think I will. Please, take one. No, I mustn't. No, take one. No, really. All right.
JC puts them back in his pocket. Pause.
I wish I hadn't refused that cigarette. How I wish I hadn't refused that cigarette that nice gentleman had offered me, because I... JC offers it again. Oh, thank you, he takes one. Thank you very much.
JC pulls out a lighter and prepares to light it, but discovers that Marty has put the cigarette in his pocket.
Aren't you going to smoke it? Oh, no, no, if I smoke it now, I won't have one for after. After what? After I smoke this one. If I had two cigarettes, now, it would be plain sailing.
Have another cigarette.
Oh, thank you. Keep the pack.
Marty sits for a moment and then starts talking very quietly.
Once upon a time there was a fairy prince, and his name was Arthur Aldridge, and he got on a train, and a magic wizard gave him some cigarettes.
Magic cigarettes?
What are you talking about? I'm telling myself a story to pass the time. Well, would you please tell it quietly?
Marty now tells the story to himself. We are aware only of his lips moving then.
Happily ever after. The end. He starts looking carefully all around the carriage. After a pause, I spy with my little eye something beginning with B or J. B or J. Well, how could it begin with a B or a J? For various reasons, none of which I am at liberty to divulge at this moment. B or J. Easy. What's the answer? Ectoplasm. Ectoplasm? Yes, Mr. B.J. Ectoplasm. He works at my office. But I can't see him. You can if you have an appointment.
While some of the 1948 show skits were still fairly conventional, we were slowly getting bolder about being wilder and sillier, but it was a slower process than one might think. In the first series, we did at least 7 sketches that had been performed in Cambridge Circus. There were even a couple of reworkings of sketches from Footlights days, a martial arts skit which Tim, Gray and I had done in the 1962 review, and Gray's one-man wrestling bout. Using well-tested material here and there boosted our confidence at a time when we were still unsure of ourselves. We also did a fair amount of physical comedy, which had been largely absent from the various Frost programs. Here, the humour was in the action, Marty constantly falling asleep while appealing for funds to help fellow sufferers from narcolepsy, a policeman chasing a burglar in a library as quietly as possible, a minister falling apart during a TV party political broadcast, later rewritten for Monty Python, a dentist having so much trouble with getting at a back tooth that he has to climb into the patient's mouth, created on a separate set, of course, and a very surreal idea of Marty's, an escaped criminal taking refuge under an opera singer's vast skirt while she is singing an aria. "We know you're in there, Murphy," says the armed police who surround him. "Come and get me, you dirty rats!" The team got on very well during the 6 shows of the first series. We laughed a lot. There were no heated, edgy arguments of the upcoming Cleese Jones variety. We all liked our director, Ian Fordyce, and the staff was sweet and helpful. It also helped that I was becoming more relaxed as a performer about making mistakes. I remember, for example, tripping up on the following 4-line quickie written by Eric Idle that I was performing straight to camera. "Are you bright, hard-working, ambitious, intelligent, and quick-witted, with a good personality and a smart appearance? Do you get on well with people and find that they look on you as a natural leader? Do you feel that you're being held back in your present position, and that with a go-ahead firm, you'd go right to the top? Cocky little devil, aren't you?" The second take went fine, but afterwards, in the green room, I was taken to task by a friend. "How could you get it wrong?" she said. "It was only 4 sentences." I started to explain, but she was on the attack and became quite rude about my lapse. Now, I'd already invited her to a dinner party at my place later that week, so I said, "Here's a bet. If you can do it correctly at Friday's dinner, I'll give you 20 quid. And I gave her the script. On Friday, she arrived and wanted to do it immediately, but I stalled her and introduced her to my friends and announced that dinner was served. Towards the end of the meal, I explained the bet. Everyone got a bit excited, and I asked her if she wanted to leave the table to practice it. She declined, so I prolonged dinner by serving extra drinks, although she'd hardly drunk at all, of course. And then we went into the living room to get ready for her performance, and I suddenly remembered that I'd forgotten to make a phone call, so I ran off, and the call took some time. And when I got back, I asked her if she was ready, and she was, so I outlined the bet one more time and then said, "Cue." And, of course, she got about 5 syllables out before she fluffed. And as she left later, I gave her my most naughty smile and said, "Now you know why I screwed it up, and there are only 5 people here tonight." Performing sketches, then, could still cause a little stress from time to time. So, too, could censorship problems, at least for the nice middle-aged lady called Jane, whose job it was to worry about these things. Tim and I were nominally in charge of the script. We had some sort of vague titles. So when there was an issue with it, we were the ones who went to see Jane. She was very nice, but she worried about everything. "Jane, you set this sketch in a town hall in Richmond." Tim: "Yes." "Jane, well, there are 2 towns in Britain called Richmond." Me: "And?" "Well, one of them might complain." Me: "But there's nothing rude about the town." "No, no, but I am concerned." Tim: "Okay, let's call it Gooley. Thank you." As for the rest of us, our anxieties were almost entirely script-related and arose because our pattern of rehearsal was as follows. First day, read through. Everything looks fine, so afterwards, write for next week's show. Second day, rehearsal. On second thoughts, 2 sketches feel a bit weak, so the evening is spent rewriting them. One of them is now much better. Third day, rehearsal. 1 sketch still not working, so rewrite in evening, but by now we have lost all confidence in it, so start thinking of new sketch to replace it. Eventually think of one. Write it. Fourth day, rehearsal. New sketch doesn't work. We stop rehearsing early, so we have extra time to come up with new sketch. We are feeling tired and a bit anxious and don't like any of our new ideas, as they all seem derivative. Write 2 new sketches. Fifth day, rehearsal. New sketches stink. Panic looms, depressed as well as tired, devoid of funny thoughts. Sixth day, rehearsal. We borrow a sketch from next week's script, but it doesn't feel very funny either, and we don't have time to rehearse it properly. Seventh day, bad night's sleep, recording in front of live audience. Show goes rather well, so suicide pact put on hold, and we celebrate instead. Eighth day, new script doesn't feel as good as last night's, and we are already a sketch short. Spend evening trying to write, but too tired and stressed. And so on, and so on. Panic, anxiety, loss of sense of humour, insomnia, depression, bleeding from ears, migraines, vertigo, loss of appetite, blurred vision, nocturnal enuresis, etc., etc. But no tensions within the team, just fear the show would be bad. Writing and performing in these 6 shows taught me an important creative principle. The more anxious you feel, the less creative you are. Your mind ceases to play and be expansive. Fear causes your thinking to contract, to play safe. And this forces you into stereotypical thinking. And in comedy, you must have innovation because an old joke isn't funny. I therefore came up with Cleese's 2 rules of writing comedy. First rule, get your panic in early. Fear gives you energy, so make sure you have plenty of time to use that energy. The same rule applies to exams. Second rule, your thoughts follow your mood. Anxiety produces anxious thoughts, sadness begets sad thoughts, anger, angry thoughts. So aim to be in a relaxed, playful mood when you try to be funny. We all thought the reaction to the shows would be all right because the studio audiences liked them, but the response was better than we expected, especially from the TV critics. They were paid a lot of attention in those days, and some of them were worth it then. But there was one in particular, Philip Purser of The Telegraph, whose opinion we cared about a lot. So when he wrote a review in which he criticised ITV for not showing the programme nationally, he wrote, "If I lived in the Midlands, say, I'd be mutinous by now." And he went on, "If it weren't for Alan Bennett, we'd be hailing it as the funniest thing for years. We were over several astronomical entities, some of which were very distant." On the whole, the critics tended to pick me out while missing Marty. They spotted him the following autumn, though. Before I develop the narrative further, one more favourite sketch, and this time not read by me, but actually as Gray and I once recorded it.
Come in. Ah, good morning. Do come in.
Thank you.
Do sit down now. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm interested in your memory training course.
Oh, good. Well, a lot of people feel that they'd like to improve their memories, and the wonderful thing is, improving them is not as hard as nails.
I beg your pardon?
As hard as nails. It's word association. You see, the basis of my system. You remember things by associating with people like that.
People like what?
They like to improve their memories. Now, what can I do for you?
Well, I'm interested in your course.
Good. You remember that, you see? You've learned to associate your interest in my course with my asking why you're here. You see? Association of ideas. It's the basis of everything we do to acquire a better memory. But it's not as hard as,
I'd think.
No, hard as nails. Remember? Never mind. You'll soon pick it up. Now, take a common object like this.
A saucer.
Good. Well done. Now, what does it make you think of?
Well, what
would you like to think of?
Like to think of?
A nude woman.
A nude woman?
Well done. Well done, you're getting it. And what is the nude woman doing?
Drinking tea.
Good. And what's she drinking tea out of?
A cup.
Quite right. Cup. Cup and saucer. It's a saucer. Do you get the idea?
Well, I'm not sure.
What is the association of ideas? That's the basis of our method. Indeed, of the whole hole in the wall. And what do I see? Through the hole in the wall, a nude woman. Every time.
Every time?
Of course, it's such a strong image, you can't forget that. And you associate that with anything you want to remember. Anything. Numbers, dates, names. Try me.
Battle of Trafalgar.
Trafalgar Square, hole in the wall. Look through the hole in the wall. What do I see?
A nude woman.
Excellent, excellent. Who is this nude woman?
I don't know.
The Empress Josephine, 1815. Rhymes, you see? Josephine, 1815.
1815 was Waterloo. Trafalgar was 1805.
Wait a minute. I haven't finished it. Josephine's wearing boots, Wellington boots. You can't see her toes. So deduct the 10 you can't see from 1815, 1805. Simple.
All right, the date of Waterloo.
1815.
Yes, but how do you do it?
Battle of Waterloo. Waterloo Station. Train to Brighton. Brighton Pier. Pier through the hole in the wall. And there's the Empress Josephine in the new Josephine, 1815.
But you've got to deduct 10. She's got Wellington boots on.
No. Battle of Waterloo. Duke of Wellington. In he comes, wants his boots back, so we see her toes. No need to deduct 10. Waterloo, 1815. See?
Fire of London?
What?
The date of the Fire of London.
Let me think. Fire of London. Fire, fiery, diary, Samuel Pepys. Yes, Pepys wrote in this diary about the Fire of London. Samuel Pepys, through the hole in the wall. What does he see?
A nude woman?
No. Three nude women. By the light of the fire, he sees three stunning, gorgeous nude women. 666, 1666. Easy, is it? Foolproof.
Ah, it's good to hear his voice again. Despite the success of the series, the feeling of responsibility was killing me. And when the 1948 show was finished, I fell in a heap and lay there for a week. Once I had recovered, Gray and I settled down to start writing the new Frost reports. The Chinese have a blessing. May you live in uninteresting times. So I was blessed to be doing this second series with David. For 3 months, there was calm, order, predictability, not a hint of a crisis or anything else interesting. The show ran smoothly. David was genial. Jimmy Gilbert, charming and well-organized. I was less stressed. The writers had all become good friends, and the two Ronnies were funny. Just funny, whatever they did. Ronnie Corbett's timing was still an education for me, but I also began to notice Ronnie Barker's supreme competence. This sounds like faint praise, but it's his own fault because he made everything look so easy. No matter how difficult or complex a sketch was, he always just did it. Gray and I wrote a sketch we particularly liked because it was a bit wilder than the Frost norm. Ronnie B. played the big part, with Ronnie C. feeding him. Adrian Wapcaplet sits in his luxurious advertising agency office. The client, Mr. Simpson, enters, and Wapcaplet, played by Barker, rises to greet him.
Ah, Mr. Simpson. Welcome to Mouse Bat, Follicle, Loose Liver, Wallaby, and Cyst Brothers.
Brothers?
Yes, we like to think of ourselves as one big happy family. We like to think of our clients as our children. My name's Piglust, but you can call me Daddy.
Danny Piglust.
That's right. Now then, Mr. Simpson. That's a funny name. You're not foreign, are you?
No.
Oh, that's all right. Now then, Mr.
Simpson.
Simpson, that was it. You came to me to advertise your washing powder.
String,
washing powder. What's the difference? We can sell anything in it.
Oh, good. Yeah. You see, I've got this 112,000 miles of string.
Yes.
And I thought if we mounted a national campaign...
Campaign? What a marvellous idea. Well, it's no trouble there. Very useful stuff, string, you know.
Yes, there's just one snag.
Yes.
Due to bad planning, this 112,000 miles of string is in 3-inch lengths. You see, it's not really very useful.
3-inch lengths, eh?
Yeah.
Well, that'll be our selling point. Simpson's individual stringettes.
What?
Yes, the Now string. Ready cut, easy to handle, Simpson's individual emperor stringettes. Just the right length.
For what?
Oh, 100 household uses.
Such as?
Tying up very small parcels. attaching notes to pigeons' legs. Or destroying household pests.
Destroying household pests, how?
Yeah, well, if they're bigger than that, you can strangle them, and if they're smaller than that, you can flog them to death with them.
But surely...
No, destroy 99% of known household pests with pre-sliced, rust-proof, easy-to-handle, low-calorie Simpsons individual emperor stringettes, free from artificial colouring, as used in hospitals.
Hospitals?
Have you ever been in a hospital where they don't use string?
No, but I mean, after all, it is only string.
Only string? It's got everything. It's waterproof.
It isn't.
Well, it's water-resistant.
It isn't.
Well, then, it's non-waterproof. It's super-absorbent string. Absorb water with Simpson's individual water-absorbent stringettes. Away with floods.
But you just said it was waterproof.
Away with a dull drudgery of floods and workaday tidal waves. Use Simpson individual flood preventers.
You're mad!
Shut up. Now, listen, see. Let's see. Sex. We must get sex into this. I know. We'll have a television commercial. You see, there's this nude woman sitting in the bath holding a bit of your string. That's very good. Now... We want a doctor in there. We must get the medical opinion, you see. So we'll have a doctor in the bath with a nude woman, and they're both holding a piece of string. No. That's too sexy. Much too sexy. I know. We'll have an archbishop standing watching them. That'll take the edge off it. Yes. We've got the archbishop in the bath with a nude woman. They're both holding a bit of string, and the doctor standing there. Now then, we should want animals and children. So there's two children admiring the bit of string, and a little dog admiring the archbishop. How's that? And the archbishop is blessing the string. Now, we must get an international flavour. International flavour into this. I know. Make him a Greek Orthodox archbishop. That's it. Why not Archbishop Makarios? Yes. So we've got Archbishop Makarios in the bath with a nude woman and the doctor and the two dogs and the children. Oh, we won't have dogs. We'll have an ostrich. It's more international. You see? And then Archbishop Makarios comes forward very sexily, dripping wet, out of the bath, and he says, prevent household floods with Simpson's individual nude women. The international passport to not tying pleasure. Destroys 99% of household pests.
You're mad. You're out of your mind.
No, we can't do that. We can't do that. That's Pritchard's instant custard advert.
Not that zany, I agree, but we were getting there. With the final Frost report under our belt, Gray and I spent a few days on the Rimmer script and then jumped in a limo with Tim and Marty to be driven up to Manchester for an appearance on the big chat show of those days, D-Time. Hosted by Simon D. My first television interview back in the days of the Frost Report had been a grim experience, but this time I really rather enjoyed myself. Not least, I fear, because the four of us behaved rather badly. We'd never met Simon before when we walked onto his show, which was live, and I'm not sure he quite knew which one of us was which. And he certainly had no idea as to the identity of the fifth member of our group, since this was the guy who'd driven the limo from London and whom we decided to invite on with us. Once our driver had sat down, he decided to take off his shoes and socks and began eating a sandwich which he'd brought with him. Dee was understandably bewildered, but wisely didn't risk an introduction, and the interview proceeded without any clarification. The moment Simon turned away from us to introduce the first commercial break, we hid behind our sofa so effectively that when the poor man turned back from his announcements, he thought we'd left, and a panic ensued. The reason we were feeling naughty was because we were all about to go on holiday. Graham was due to spend a month in Mykonos, which slightly surprised us, as it was an island known for its gay lifestyle, even in 1967, so it didn't strike me as being his kind of place. And Tim and I were flying to Brussels the next day to link up with Alan Hutchison, so that the three of us could travel together down to Italy by car to take a beach holiday in Elba. Strangely enough, given that I didn't have a driving licence, the car we were driving was mine. The success of the television ventures had inspired me to acquire a rather beautiful and expensive old Bentley, £2,000, which I'd fallen in love with not just because it was decked out in British racing green, but because it was big, with childbearing hips and a big walnut dashboard and big walnut trays built into the back of the front seats, so that people could sit in the back and have picnics while being driven around in Oxfordshire. I'd started to learn to drive, and in the meantime had acquired a provisional driving licence that allowed me to drive my car along the road, provided I put L plates up and had a qualified driver sitting next to me. And I'd also bought a chauffeur's cap to confuse people who'd seen the L plates. Once Alan had picked him and me up at Brussels Airport, we began driving south. Actually, Alan was driving because they wouldn't allow me behind the wheel. All three of us in high spirits, playing up the role of young English gentlemen abroad. We wore Panama hats. I had on a cricket shirt and a cravat. And as Alan drove the first leg of our journey, Tim and I did a lot of royal waving out of the window, smiling and nodding graciously to the Belgian folk and blessing them. An hour later, we retraced our journey. This time, all three of us were sitting in the back of the Bentley, and we were still waving and behaving regally, but the car was slanting graciously backwards, with the front wheels a couple of feet off the ground, suspended from the rescue truck that was towing us. Alan had put our car under a juggernaut, or, for American listeners, a large truck, at a roundabout, while I was reading the map, and Tim in the back was unavailingly crying, "Priority à droite! Priority à droite!" We left the Bentley and Tim at a garage, and Alan and I travelled back to Brussels to hire a much less magnificent vehicle. When we picked Tim up the next morning, he told us that he'd spent the night in his room with a bird. Intrigued, we questioned him closely and learned that he had been awoken in the middle of the night by a strange, rather alarming noise like this. And then when he put the light on, he discovered a turkey vomiting on the mantelpiece. He thought of complaining, but found that his phrasebook did not cover this particular contingency. So, in reduced circumstances, the three of us drove down to Pisa Airport and collected another bird called Christine. Tim had met her at the first 1948 show recording in mid-February, and I'm pleased to report they married in 1968. When I got back from Italy, I found a message from Harry Secombe asking if we could meet between shows at the London Palladium, where he was headlining their big summer production with help from my Frost Report friend, Nicky Henson. My God, they worked hard, somehow managing to do three shows every Saturday. Nicky enjoyed the experience of playing the huge Palladium Theatre with its packed summertime audience. The only bit he found difficult was the moment the curtain went up on the Saturday matinee, when he was hit by a smell of sweaty armpits from the audience that would have felled a camel. Nicky also told me a typical Secombe story. A few weeks after the show opened, Harry found out what all the dancers were being paid. He immediately insisted the show's accountants put an extra £5 in each dancer's wage packet and deduct it from his own salary. There were a lot of dancers, and they never knew. It's unusual to meet a man who's truly lovable. But Harry was one of those men, and that's probably why I felt so angry for him during our first meeting in his dressing room. I'd arrived after the matinee and still remember an autograph hunter at the stage door asking me, "Are you anybody?" I was tempted to answer him ontologically, but instead told him a white lie and denied my own existence. When Harry greeted me, he immediately presented me with a beautiful coffee table book, a copy of J.B. Priestley's Man and Time. He'd remembered our conversation in Barbados 6 months before. He then asked me if I would write some sketches for him to perform in a big TV special he had planned. I was genuinely thrilled. We chatted about ideas, and then his agent, Jimmy Grafton, arrived and handed Harry a script which he'd written for him, a big set piece to end another show. Harry started to read it, so I made some notes of the sketch ideas we'd just come up with. However, I slowly became aware that Harry was looking very worried by what he was reading. He clearly thought it wasn't funny. But being so good-natured, he was terribly uncomfortable about making any sort of critical comment to Jimmy, who by now was immersed in a conversation with somebody else. Eventually, Harry cleared his throat a couple of times and said, I think this still needs a little work, Jimmy. Jimmy looked round, almost irritated. He'd been interrupted. What? Jimmy, I don't think this is quite right yet. It's fine, Harry. You'll make it funny. And he turned back to a conversation that was clearly of more interest to him. And Harry just sat there looking quite dejected, and rightly so, at the prospect of labouring his way through unfunny material in front of countless silent audiences, while his agent, having treated Harry's query with something approaching contempt, raked in the royalties without needing to make any further effort. Being so low in the pecking order and a yellow belly by inclination, I said nothing. I felt impotent. But that this lovely man should be so callously exploited by a lazy, soulless agent made my blood boil, and I vowed to myself that I would never, never be so nice and agreeable and cooperative that bullies and slackers could walk all over me and force me to do things I might be ashamed of. And I think I can claim that I've usually managed to curb my placatory tendencies and go toe-to-toe when necessary. This, as it happens, is seldom required, and when it is, I don't exactly enjoy it. Nevertheless, as a therapist once said to me, if people cannot hear you, you may need to raise your voice. And for any Daily Mail journalist reading this, I should explain he was speaking largely metaphorically. Fortunately, Harry liked the sketches I'd written for him, and so did the audience. All, in fact, went very smoothly with our collaboration, and the only slight hiccup I can recall occurred when he was reading a monologue off the autocue and one of his new contact lenses started to rotate and he had to take it out. I've never seen one like it. It looked as though it had been part of a milk bottle. He must have had to put his eye in it rather than vice versa. Meanwhile, I had been asked to perform my first movie, a film called Interlude. It was a straight part with only a couple of slightly humorous lines, but I was very excited nonetheless. The role was that of a PR man at a TV company who's looking after a young woman journalist who has come to the company studios to interview a famous Austrian conductor. An affair ensues between the conductor and the journalist. Filming took place at the same Wembley TV studios where a few months before I'd done all the Frost programmes, so the setting could not have been more familiar, especially as my first scene took place in the canteen. As I settled into my first ever day on a feature film, several things surprised me. The sheer size of the crew. There must have been 35 in the canteen, all carrying out various jobs. The length of time between each camera setup, the charming old-fashioned courtesy of the crew, everyone called me sir, the number of takes that it required before anyone decided we could move on. I was also deeply impressed by the sedate, polite atmosphere and the sheer efficiency of the crew. An actor once told me the difference between British and French film crews. The former, a great craftsman who seldom go to the cinema and never discuss film. The French argue passionately all the time about cinema, but aren't that hot at their jobs. This efficiency, I later discovered, was partly down to the director, Kevin Billington, a man of immense energy, but also calm and effortlessly friendly, who thought and spoke with unusual clarity. Thanks to him, the crew always knew what they were doing and what they would be doing next. Later, I was to work with many directors who operated in a very different way, substituting a mood of hushed panic for Kevin's calm progress. So, my first experience of filming was hugely positive. I even got on well with the star, Oscar Werner, although he had viewed me rather suspiciously for the first couple of days. He was much shorter than I was. Then we got talking about food, and we never looked back. Unknown to me, while I was beavering away on my various projects, a lot was happening on the Chapman front. When he got back from Greece, he called and invited Pippa and me to a party in Hampstead. We went, and we found it very crowded, and after we'd all greeted each other, I drifted off with some other friends to watch a nail-biting football match on the TV. When it finally ended, Pippa was standing there. "Graham's gone," she said. "Oh, well, we'll see him Monday. He wanted to talk to you. What about?" "I'll tell you in the taxi." Once we were in the taxi, Pip said, "Well, he had to go, but he gave me a message for you. He's come out. He lives in Hampstead." No. He's decided he's gay."
"What?"
"He's homosexual." "Who are we talking about?" "Graham."
"Graham who?"
"Graham Chapman." Yes, I know, but who does Grace say is gay?"
"He is."
"I'm sorry, I'm lost. Graham Chapman, yes. He's decided he's a homosexual. He wants you to know he has a boyfriend." "What is all this about, Pip?"
"It's true, but why is he trying to wind me up?"
He isn't.
"Is it a bet?"
It's a good thing that the taxi ride back to Kensington was a long one, because Pippa needed every minute of it to convince me. While in Mykonos, Gray had met an impressive Swede called Stig, and Stig had convinced him that when he got back to London, he should tell all his friends that he'd been living with his boyfriend, David, ever since they met in Ibiza over a year before. As we got out of the cab, Pip said, "Graham wants you to tell Marty." So I telephoned Marty, and we had an identical conversation, except that I was now doing Pippa's lines and Marty was doing mine. The only difference was that Marty got quite irritated. "John, love, it's 11 o'clock. Why are you calling me?" "I just told you, Marty. Please don't mess me around, love. It's not funny." Graham always used to say I was shocked when he came out, and that implies some sort of moral objection. Untrue. I was not shocked. I was very, 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 very surprised. I'd known Gray for over 5 years, and he had always worn brogue shoes and cord trousers and a sports jacket with leather patches on the elbows, and he'd been a beer-drinking, pipe-smoking, rugby-football-playing medical student. Now, in the 1960s, if you were wondering if someone might be gay, these habits were not thought of as a dead giveaway. Unless, of course, the person in question was female. Gray now organised a coming-out party, and all Gray's friends met David, and a good time was had by all. In retrospect, the most surprising thing after the news was how little anything actually changed. Certainly didn't affect our writing relationship. But I think our material was actually getting better as we became more experienced and confident. The second series of the 1948 show was due to start in late September, so Tim, Marty, Gray and I settled down to write. We saw no need to make alterations in the format or the style of the show, but we now had a much clearer idea of what we were trying to accomplish. And that, combined with greater confidence and the fact that we no longer had old material to fall back on, led to scripts that were more zany, madcap, and off the wall, and therefore getting closer than ever to Monty Python. As the series progressed, it became obvious to us all that Marty was growing stronger and stronger as a performer. His technique had improved remarkably quickly, and the need for intense rehearsal sessions with him became much less frequent. Vocally, he was not the finished article, as his odd voice production meant that he sometimes lost the rhythms of sketches that were heavy on dialogue. But if he could just respond to questions rather than taking the lead in a sketch, he could be hilarious.
"Engine driver Spriggs, sir."
"Ah, oh, Spriggs. You again.
Is that all, sir?"
"Yes, Spriggs." "Sit down, please."
"It wasn't me, sir."
"Quiet, Spriggs. You know, I don't have an easy job, Spriggs.
No, sir, I know you don't, sir.
I suppose each week I have to investigate about 30 serious complaints against the railways.
Yes, sir.
In a bad week, perhaps 50.
Yes, sir.
And each complaint takes a great deal of time.
Yes, sir, I know it does, sir.
Last week, Spriggs, I had to investigate several serious complaints against you personally.
Oh, sir.
Actually, about 40,000.
I'm sorry, sir.
That's a lot of complaints, Spriggs.
It is, sir, a lot, sir.
I haven't been able to leave this office for days. Days. As a result, my wife has gone off with an Arab, my dogs are dead, and somebody's opened a Chinese restaurant in my bedroom.
I'm sorry, sir. Can I go now?
40,000 complaints, Spriggs.
Yes, sir.
About Monday's incident.
Oh, sir.
Last Monday, Spriggs, you were scheduled to drive the 10:15 to Bristol.
Yes, sir.
But you didn't take it, did you, Spriggs?
No, sir.
You took a cattle train.
Yes, sir.
Why, Spriggs?
I like animals, sir.
You like animals?
Yes, sir, especially cows.
So you took 700 of them?
Yes, sir.
The entire London to Brighton cattle train? To Manchester.
Yes, sir.
Why Manchester, Spriggs?
Well, I've been to Brighton, sir.
So you took 700 cows to Manchester?
Yes, sir. Travel broadens the mind, sir.
But even if you wanted to go north, Spriggs, why didn't you take the up line?
I got confused, sir.
But you ignored all the signals.
I was out of my cabin, sir.
Sitting on the engine flying your kite. Yes, I've seen the photographs. Did in the papers. What are you laughing at, Spriggs?
I'm trying to break the ice, sir.
Don't push me, Spriggs. Now, about Manchester Cathedral.
I forgot to stop, sir.
Yes, I know, Spriggs. The traffic policemen have told me. So has the Archbishop. He has described the arrival of you and your locomotive in the nave during the 49th Psalm in no little detail. It seems to have been an unnerving experience for the entire congregation, Spriggs.
I said I was sorry, sir.
He goes on to say, Spriggs, that when he tried to restore calm by mounting what was left of the pulpit to begin his sermon, you started shunting operations in the East Transept.
I was in his way, sir. I was trying to help him, sir.
Then why did you release the cows?
I panicked, so I couldn't see it all the steam.
Neither could the congregation, Spriggs. That's why the cows came as rather a shock. The organ and the clanking and the hot steam would have impressed an atheist, let alone those who believe in the wrath of God. Even the Archbishop have said he thought it was the end of the world.
I could pay for the damage, so I took a collection.
Yes, the Archbishop's telling you. No, Spriggs, I'm going to punish you, Spriggs.
Oh, sir.
Very severely, Spriggs.
Oh, sir.
You are to write out 50 times, Spriggs. I must not drive my trains into Manchester Cathedral.
Yes,
now, get out.
Yes, sir.
Oh, Spriggs?
Yes, sir.
Where are last week's lines?
Yes, sir.
Buckingham's got a capital B, Spriggs, and there's only one L in Paris.
Finally, I want to present to you the best sketch Marty and I ever did together. This time he was leading the dialogue as Mr. Pest, but he was word perfect and pitch perfect. A quite spacious bookshop. A customer, Mr. Pest, enters and approaches the counter behind which stands an assistant, played by me.
Good morning. Can you help me? Do you have a copy of 30 Days in the Samarkand Desert with a Spoon by A.E.J. Elliott?
Well, we haven't got it in stock, sir.
How about 101 Ways to Start a Monsoon?
By?
An Indian gentleman whose name eludes me for the moment.
Well, I don't know the book, sir.
Not to worry, not to worry. Can you help me with David Copperfield?
Ah, yes. Dickens.
No. No, Edmund Wells.
I think you'll find Charles Dickens wrote David Copperfield.
No, Charles Dickens wrote David Copperfield with two P's. This is David Copperfield with one P by Edmund Wells.
Well, in that case, we don't have it.
Funny, you've got a lot of books here.
Yes, we do have quite a lot of books here. We don't have David Copperfield with one P by Edmund Wells. We only have David Copperfield with two P's by Charles Dickens.
Pity, it's more thorough than the Dickens.
More thorough?
Yes, I wonder if it's worth having a look through David Copperfield.
I'm quite sure that all our David Copperfields have two P's.
Probably, but the original by Edmund Wells also had two P's. It was after that that they ran into copyright difficulties.
No, I'm quite sure that all our David Copperfields with two P's are by Charles Dickens.
But how about Great Expectations?
Ah, yes, we have that.
That's G-R-A-T-E, Expectations, also by Edmund Wells.
Or in that case, we don't have it. We don't have anything by Edmund Wells, actually. He's not very popular.
Not Nicholas Nickleby? That's K-N-I-C-K-E-R. Nicholas.
No.
Or Christmas Carol with a Q.
No, definitely not.
Sorry to trouble you.
Not at all.
I wonder if you have a copy of Barnaby Budge.
No, as I say, we're right out of Edmund Wells.
No, not Edmund Wells, Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens?
Yes.
You mean Barnaby Rudge?
No, Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens. That's Dickens with two Ks, the well-known Dutch author.
No, no, we don't have Barnaby Budge by Charles Dickens with two Ks, the well-known Dutch author. And perhaps to save time, I should add right away that we don't have Carnaby Fudge by Giles Dickens or Stickwick Stapers by Miles Pickens with four M's and a silent Q. Why don't you try the chemist?
I have. They sent me here.
Did they?
I wonder if you have the Amazing Adventures of Captain Gladys Stoat pamphlet and her intrepid spaniel Steak among the giant pygmies of Corsica, volume 2.
No, no, we don't have that one. Funny, we've got quite a lot of books here.
Yes, haven't you?
Well, I mustn't keep you standing around all day
chatting.
No, no, we haven't. No,
we're closing for lunch now. Well, I thought I saw it over there.
Where?
Over there.
What?
Olsen's Standard Book of British Birds.
Olsen's Standard Book of British Birds?
Yes.
O-L-S-E-N?
Yes.
B-I-R-D-S?
Yes.
Yes, well, we do have that one.
The expurgated version, of course.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
The expurgated version.
The expurgated version of Olsen's Standard Book of British Birds?
Yes, the one without the gannet.
The one without the gannet? They've all got the gannet. It's a standard British bird, the gannet. It's in all the books.
Well, I don't like them. No nasty beaks.
You can't expect them to produce a special edition for gannet haters.
Well, I'm sorry. I especially want the one without the gannet.
All right. Anything else?
Well, I'm not too keen on robins.
Right, robins. No gannets, no robins. There's your book.
I can't buy that. It's torn.
It's torn. So it is.
I wonder if you've got...
Go on, ask me another. We've got lots of books here. This is a bookshop, you know.
How about Biggles Combs His Hair?
No, 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 we don't have that one. No, no, funny. Try me again.
Have you got Ethel the Aardvark Goes Quantity Surveying?
No, 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 we haven't. Which one?
Ethel the Aardvark Goes Quantity Surveying.
Ethel the Aardvark? I see it. We've got it. We've got it, someone. Ethel the Aardvark. Now, buy it!
I haven't got enough money on me.
I'll take a deposit.
I haven't got any money on me.
I'll take a cheque.
I haven't got a chequebook.
It's all right, I've got a bank one.
I don't have a bank account.
Right! I'll buy it for you! There we are, there's your change. Let's put that taxi on the way home.
Wait, what? I can't read.
You can't read?
No.
Right, sit!
This character of Mr. Pest suited Marty so brilliantly that we reprised it several times, but now making him more physically destructive, leaving behind vandalised sets as well as broken psyches. Marty was so funny in these sketches that people rightly recognised his emergence as a real star. Meanwhile, there was one incident quite unrelated to Grey's new lifestyle, which in retrospect seems significant in terms of the light that it sheds on my collaboration with Grey. At the end of the filming of Interlude, my new friend Oscar Werner had given me, as a memento, the baton with which he had been conducting the orchestra. I really treasured it, and Grey noticed it on my desk one day, and I told him the story of how I'd acquired it, and he asked if he could pick it up, and I said yes, of course. And he started flexing it, bending it in an arc, but doing so a little harder each time. I nearly said, careful, but it felt unnecessary, and then Grey flexed it very hard, and it snapped. And what was so odd was that he didn't seem at all surprised or put out. He just said, oh, and then put the pieces back on the desk, and then in a completely neutral voice added, sorry. I was bemused, but in the tradition that became so much a part of Monty Python, I said nothing. Looking back on this with the benefit of hindsight, what Grey treated as the most trivial matter comparable to dropping a biscuit on someone's carpet might have been a sign of some competitiveness between us that was never acknowledged. I say this because I intuitively connect the baton story with something that happened quite early on in the Monty Python era. Grey arrived for rehearsal, and immediately and untypically started telling us all about a dream he'd had the night before. He'd found that he'd been made Chancellor of the Exchequer, sitting at his desk issuing orders, signing important papers and lording it over his civil servants, and having a wonderful time being King of the Castle until he discovered that the Prime Minister was me. The way he told it was quite painful. The news about my status really did shatter his dream. The glory of being the second most powerful man in Britain had vanished without trace. So, by November 1967, I was beginning to feel I badly needed a break. Between March 66 and November 67, I'd done Frost Reports 27, 1948 shows 13, Frost Programs at least 40. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. 41 shows, film scripts in production 2, TV pilot scripts 1, TV appearances about 12, film appearances 1. But now I seemed at last to have a bit of time to myself, and I found my mind turning to some unfinished business. Sometime during the course of the second series of the Frost Report in the spring of 1967, I received a Dear John letter from Connie. She felt that our geographical separation meant that it was not possible for the relationship to develop naturally, and she wanted us to become just dear friends. It was a sweet and affectionate letter. It was also a shock. I could understand her decision, and when someone wants to break up, it always seemed to me futile to try to prolong the agony, but I also felt very sad. I have the clearest memory of sitting on a park bench on Shepherd's Bush Green, just 50 yards from the beautiful old converted theatre from which we used to transmit the Frost Report every week. There'd been a break in camera rehearsal, and I'd wandered outside to gather my thoughts, and I found myself quite seriously considering whether I should just give up show business and go to New York to live and perhaps earn my crust as a writer or even as a banker. After all, two of my Cambridge friends were banking away happily in Manhattan, and the relationship with Connie could blossom naturally there. I also meditated on whether I required a change of personality, or perhaps just a change of name would do. I'd always thought that John, though very popular in England since King John's reign, and despite it, too, was rather dull and tame, worthy and honest, but not at all sparky. Of course, in the old days, Johns were often called Jack, which is a much better handle, a bit cheeky, cheerful and, let's face it, sexy. Whoever heard of a Dear Jack letter? A Jack would tear the damn thing up. In addition, I'd always preferred Cheese to Cleese, which is, quite simply, not a proper name. So I thought, if I had been Jack Cheese, I could have gone to live in Monterey and started a bank and written in the evenings and had children with Constance Cheese, who would never have been able to resist Jack's advances. Because my relationship with Connie had been so on and off and was now off, I had become ever closer to Pippa, whom, as you will recall, I'd first met in Ibiza. She was kind, cheerful, fun, and just plain easy to be around. Ultimately, though, I came to the rather hackneyed conclusion that though I was incredibly fond of her, I wasn't actually in love with her. I would like to have been, but I wasn't, and that seemed crucial. What's more, I realized that I was not able to extinguish my feelings for Connie, despite the Dear John letter, and that I was still probably, on average, taking things overall at a conservative estimate, in love with her, even though she wasn't almost certainly in love with me. However, one thing I knew for sure was that I felt unsettled in a quiet but all-important way. So I phoned Connie and gave her some cock and bull story about having to come to New York for work reasons and said it would be nice to see her while I was there. When she didn't tell me to drop dead, I jumped on a plane and, once at my hotel, called her. She told me that she'd arranged a small party for me the following evening, just friends of hers whom I knew from my time in New York. And at that, my heart sank. I realized that by having friends there, she was making sure that emotions would be kept under control, and so was clearly indicating how she viewed my visit. I thanked her and rang off. Ah, well. The next day I went to the party and set eyes on Connie for the first time in several months. She was very friendly. We chatted and I came to the reluctant conclusion that there was nothing between us anymore. Absolutely nothing. Nevertheless, I acted all cheerful and optimistic and after a couple of hours was able to make excuses about jet lag and slink back to my hotel as bereft as an artichoke. Except that halfway there, I suddenly thought, what is the point of this silly pretense that I'm here for work when I want to fly back home first thing tomorrow now? So I turned around, trudged back to Connie's apartment, rang the bell, confessed my pathetic plan, apologised, and found 10 minutes later that we were getting married. I have no idea what happened during those 10 minutes, but happen it did, and the two of us then went out for a celebratory dinner. Later that night, back in her apartment, we talked about practicalities for the first time about money. Connie explained that she was fairly comfortably off. Well, I had to reveal that I wasn't. That whereas in America there was much money to be made in television, working for the BBC was akin to taking a vow of poverty. And that for the Frost Report I received the grand total for the series of about £1,400, on which I then paid 83% income tax. I think I'd mentioned this before our engagement, but Connie must have thought I was joking. Only 2 years later, when I told an old Footlights friend who worked a lot in American television what I was paid per episode for Monty Python, he laughed so much that he actually fell off the sofa. Fortunately, it didn't take too long to reassure her that there was plenty of work for me in London and that we would have a reasonable standard of living there. We decided to marry in New York, though, and we agreed it would be a very small and simple affair. We both liked the idea of a proper ceremony, and so we chose a Unitarian church where all sorts of religions were embraced, and where I would be allowed to go through the service carefully removing all the references to God. The Church of England had certainly worked its magic on me. Connie had a lot of arrangements to make, so I flew back to London to look for a flat and to face the awful bit. There are few feelings worse than the mixture of dread and guilt that grips you when you are about to dump someone who doesn't deserve it. It's much easier when things between you have been difficult for some time, and it's much, much easier when it's an unpremeditated and natural denouement of a really appalling row with accusations and recriminations and long-standing resentments and a few freshly minted ones and high-octane screaming and savage insults, because then the dumping process brings immediate relief and a delightful sense of easy, glowing self-justification, at least until 72 hours later, when separation anxiety begins to kick in. But to dump someone, albeit ceremoniously, when she has been nothing but kind and cheerful and thoughtful and affectionate, just because she fails to tweak some obscure part of your unconscious, well, it makes you wish you were a sociopath or, better still, a banker. To make things even worse, Pippa took it very well. But she wanted to leave London for a time, decided on Johannesburg, and off she went. 2 years later, we bumped into each other again, and we have been great friends ever since. It's typical of Pippa that she's also got on so well with most of my wives.